This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, it's Megan Williams. Every Wednesday, we're bringing you a bonus podcast, one handpicked story from this week's edition of the Sunday Magazine that we think is definitely worth hearing or hearing again. You can hear all of our stories on the full podcast that we put out on Sunday and on the CBC Listen app. It's been a dark and unsettling week in the history of Canadian literature. A shocking story in the Toronto Star by one of Alice Munro's daughters revealed the husband of the Canadian Nobel laureate had sexually abused her when she was just 9 years old. Munro stayed with her husband for years after being told about the abuse, claiming it was her daughter who had betrayed her. Andrea Robbins Skinner's essay about the pain she endured all those years is reverberating in literary circles in Canada and beyond. Munro died last May. Joining me to discuss the now complicated legacy of Alice Munro are three Canadian writers. Heather O'Neill is author of Lullabies for Little Children and The Girl Who Was Saturday Night. Stephen Marsh is the author of Raymond and Hannah and the Next Civil War, Dispatches from the American Future. And Sarah Weinman wrote The Real Lolita, The Kidnapping of Sally Horner and the Novel That Scandalized the World, and Scoundrel, the true story of the murderer who charmed his way to fame and freedom. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Good morning.
Hi there.
Good morning. Sarah, let me start with you. How did you feel when you read Andrea Robbins Skinner's essay?
I would say that I read her essay with shock and revulsion. I read it. It felt like my heart was in my throat. It was immediately clear to me how credible and how moving and how brave and courageous she was for writing this piece and essentially upending everyone's idea of who Alice Munro was and really, you know, creating this fissure in how we think of her and her work and frankly, all of Canadian literature.
Mm-hmm. Stephen, what went through your mind?
Well, as I wrote, it was sort of like being punched in the solar plexus a bunch of times. I mean, I think it is actually the credibility of the accusation. Like, there's no real debate about it. Sometimes you get into these he said, she said mm-hmm. situations, or there's complications. Here, there's really no complication at all. There's a paper trail. And so that leads to this question of how, you know, the closest observer of Canadian domestic life in our literary history was capable of this level of self-delusion, and that just seems inconceivable on a very basic human level.
Mm-hmm. Heather, you'd been tweeting about your love for Alice Munro before Andrea Robbins Skinner's story came out. How are you feeling now about Munro as a writer and person?
It's very difficult. It changes as soon as I read the essay. Then I had to really pause because the weight of how it changed all my perceptions of Alice Munro, because, you know, she is someone I had always admired for her subversiveness, her wickedness, this idea that women ought to be free and follow their own desires. And then suddenly, how does even that hold water if she's now acting like a sociopath? And, you know, for me, it was so difficult reading it because I realized also that what she had been doing, the silence around this, was silencing her daughter's voice. Mm-hmm. And as a writer, one knows that to be, you know, a healthy, happy person, one needs to own their own narrative. And she took away somebody else's narrative. And for a writer to do that is so difficult to comprehend. And also, she was positioned as a feminist, and then she just abandoned a young woman. She was, you know, we thought she was standing up for young women, not just herself in her own freedom. So there was something so craven. And then I'm revisiting the stories in my head, but then even as a lot of people, I went back to the story Vandals, which tells a story of a neighbor who molests a child, and whether the his wife should have known or should have been more aware. And there's so much compassion and understanding. And then it made me wonder, did Alice Munro feel some sort of guilt about this, or is she just using this as fodder for another story? So it just confuses me to Alice Munro's intentions as a human being.
Yeah. You know, I think a lot of Alice Munro fans, including myself, have kind of dipped back into some of her stories to reevaluate them. One that I dipped back into is Silence. And as you mentioned, silence is so much a theme around this story. In Saturday's Toronto Star, two of Andrea Skinner's siblings, her sister Jenny and stepbrother Andrew, wrote very moving pieces about their regrets in going along with the parental silence following the abuse. But there were other people outside the family who have known about the abuse for a long time, notably her biographer, Alice Munro's biographer, Robert Thacker, and her publisher, Douglas Gibson. And they didn't make that knowledge public. What do you make of that, Stephen?
Well, I don't know. I don't really want to get into the judgment mode. I think that's probably the most useless mode to get into. I think in this country, there does tend to be these conspiracies of silence. I mean, obviously, it's not just a Canadian phenomenon, but we live in a government-funded culture rather than a market-driven culture. And because of that, our literature and our culture industries generally tend to be based on value judgments and tend to be based on virtue hierarchies. And those have fostered a lot of monsters, right? A lot of incredibly creepy people have managed to hide out in those little virtue hierarchies. And I think, you know, but I think in all seriousness, though, like, this story is much broader than that, because Alice Munro really is very, very brilliant. And which, you know, the others, perhaps, you know, they can be easily forgotten. But I don't think you really can forget Alice Munro's work. Like, its power is indisputable. And I mean, I think, you know, I too have been going over this work. I mean, I think there's a very interesting change that happens in her work between the early work and, say, the work after Open Secrets, the work where she's suppressing this narrative. And I wonder if that's eventually how we'll come to read her legacy. Like, well, there'll be the Lives of Girls and Women, Alice Munro, the Moons of Jupiter, Alice Munro, and then there'll be, you know, the later Alice Munro, which is darker. And which I think when you look at it does have a kind of, I don't know, I keep thinking about Graham Greene's line about how every novelist needs to have a particle of ice in his heart. Right. I think the iciness at the heart of Alice Munro really grew from that point. And I don't think it hurt her work either. But, you know, these are the kind of incredibly fraught questions about the nature of her art that are going to dominate the discussion, at least in the medium term, I think.
Right. Heather, what are your thoughts on that?
on what? Sorry. On the legacy?
Well, both
are the conspiracy of silence.
Both the conspiracy of silence and how this changes how you read her.
I think the conspiracy of silence. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons that this story is so triggering for people who have survived abuse, because the idea that, you know, it takes a village to abuse a child. There's the abuser and everybody who kind of facilitates it, enable it. And it's something that, you know, I experienced in my own life. And I think unlike Stephen, I was quite upset that the biographers had left that out. I mean, it's not their right to do that. You know, there's in Lewis Carroll's diaries, there's these pages that are razored out. And so we never know if he was actually a pedophile or not. And we always kind of, and with Lewis Carroll, I was like, who had the right to take those pages out? And it's with Alice Munro. How dare that biographer say that because this woman has a Nobel Prize, we have an obligation to protect her at the expense, again, at this child, you know, who's grown, but her inner child is still suffering. So I do judge those people in a way, because they were sort of enabling Alice Munro too, and also not calling her out. I mean, we should have been able to confront her when she was alive and hear her thoughts about this and go through it. So we're always, you know, I just hate that mechanism of silencing. Yeah. And it's also, you know, when children are abused, you're abused, but then you're also told at the same time to keep it silent. So you kind of live in this world where you can't speak to your own experience. So I think it's cruel that people kept that away, especially when Andrea Robyn Skinner was trying to get the story out. She was trying in so many different ways because she just felt so dehumanized.
Yeah. Now, I mean, secret keeping obviously isn't the exclusive realm of famous people. But Sarah, I'm wondering, how do you think fame changes the dynamics of the secret keeping, not just within a family, but within the publishing world?
It's this idea that you're not just a person, you're not just an author or an artist, you've become a brand. And Alice Munro, particularly when she won the Nobel in 2013, became a global brand in a way that most Canadian writers, maybe Margaret Atwood, that's about it. So I do hold the people who enabled Munro and Munro's husband, who was the actual abuser, and I think that's also important to make clear here, that he was the one who hurt Andrea Robyn Skinner first.
Yes.
And the reverberations are what we're still going to be feeling as a culture from now on. But people like Robert Thacker, who knew this incendiary information and elected not to publish it, I view that as a dereliction of duty. As someone who writes nonfiction and who reports and who writes a lot about sexual assault, you know, you have to treat this information and these people with care, and you have a tremendous responsibility. But once you know it, you cannot unknow it. And once you learn that information, it is your responsibility to do something with it. And so obviously, we can never know what would have happened if Canada and the world had learned this information in the 90s, and particularly in 2005, when Gerald Fremlin was pleaded guilty to indecent assault. But we know this now, and yes, I do think we can judge as a result.
Now, in letters detailing some of his actions, Gerald Fremlin, Andrea's abuser and Munro's husband, likened himself to Humbert Humpert, the older pedophile in Vladimir Nabokov's novel Lolita. And Sarah, you wrote a book about the real-life kidnapping of a girl that inspired the book Lolita. What was your reaction to Fremlin using Lolita in a way to justify his abuse?
I was livid, but I wasn't altogether surprised, because so many people in the years since Lolita was published legitimately in 1958, particularly, have misunderstood this novel. They have viewed it as a tragic love story, as almost like a road trip comedy, and they don't see the heart, the beating heart of this book, which is a young girl repeatedly abused by a much older man who is crying for help and who's trying to get her voice and her story out there. And she is forever co-opted, forever silenced. And as a result, it's just terrible from a fiction standpoint, but particularly for all those girls, women, and those who have been abused, whose stories, they're forever silenced, and they should not be.
Now, Heather, as Sarah just underlined, Alice Munro was not the perpetrator, but she was complicit in excusing the sexual assault against her daughter, Andrea. And there's been an incredible outpouring of support for Andrea, and also widespread condemnation of Munro for the complicity. Do you think that this is kind of ushering us into a new phase of the Me Too movement, where enablers are also being held to account?
I think it is. And I think that's why it was so resonant with people, because it's something that we don't talk about, how people surrounding families, networks, completely silence and don't do anything about an abused child. And an abused child is, you know, a collective is supposed to look after them. And we've never looked at this sort of passivity as a kind of extreme violence, and people who stand around and watch as also complicit. And I think as a child, when you are in an abusive situation, children have such an acute sense of justice, So, and they also know they're being let down. So, yeah, I do think it's a really important dialogue to have around it. And also the idea of speaking up and when it's your duty to speak up, you know, even this idea of, you know, the heartlessness of it. And we always kind of, and what's strange about the Alice Munro is so many times in the past, when you have these situations, you excuse the woman by saying, well, it was very difficult. You know, she didn't have the financial means. She didn't have the support networks, but we're talking about an incredibly wealthy, educated woman with, you know, all these kind of resources and the language of feminism at, you know, the tip of her tongue. So it's like that she doesn't have those excuses. And I think we're sort of tired of those excuses as a society, just allowing men and just blaming the man altogether. When Gerald Fremlin was clearly a pedophile. He spoke about, you know, all the other things that he said. So Alice Munro knew he was an incredibly dangerous man to have around her children. So I think it is right at this point for people, you know, for the first time to be saying, no, we don't accept this in a woman to stand by and allow a child to be abused.
Right. I'm speaking with Canadian authors Heather O'Neill, Sarah Weinman, and Stephen Marsh about the fall of Canadian literary icon Alice Munro. Stephen, what are your thoughts? I mean, you've hinted about it, but what are your thoughts about how reading works of arts changes when we discover something like this about a writer?
Well, I think, you know, broadly in culture, we've come through a period where there was this kind of spasm of rejection of any artist who was evil, right? There was this kind of idea that artists were supposed to be good people and that they were supposed to actually contribute positive thoughts and feelings towards society. You know, I think that moment has very much passed. You know, like Kanye West was number one on the charts, despite everything that he said. You know, I think people are starting the old, more complicated vision of art in which these artists were kind of sacred monsters. That's becoming much more something that we recognize as a reality, and the kind of crude politics of whatever you want to call it, cancel culture, whatever, is dead. I mean, I think it is. It survives in a very small group of institutions, but those institutions themselves are dying. So when we come to evaluate, I mean, you know, as Heather said, it takes a village, right? I mean, there is a lot of abuse, like Jim Munro sending his daughter back to the house of abuse after she had told her. I mean, it's unconscionable. It's just unbelievable. But in a sense, That's just the crime. The fact is that Alice Munro was writing about this stuff while doing it makes it seem just, I mean, that's why it's being like being hit in the solar plexus.
Yeah.
I mean, if art helps you, it does not help you escape these evils. And what is the point of writing these kind of stories, right? And I think that is really what we're going to have to face when we come to it. Now, I don't think, if you want to understand my mother's life, if you want to understand the lives of my aunts, you're going to have to read Alice Munro. She is the best chronicler of that very interesting span of time. And she gave to it a kind of detail and richness that no one else has come really even close to. And I think when you're even just as a craftsperson, like when you work in sentences and paragraphs, when you read Alice Munro, like the technique here is, I mean, it's the technique every writer in the world of in a certain literary genre is imitating, right? So she's not going away. The question is, how do we process this monstrosity at her core? And I think that is actually going to take a lot of time.
Yes. And, you know, I, as you touch upon, Stephen, I think what makes this situation feel so painful for so many readers is just the level of intimacy that she managed to access to the life of girls and women. In a way, so many readers and writers as well felt they were understood, particularly women.
And it was an illusion. It was a mask.
It
was a mask she was wearing. She was so skilled at it. It was, but it was an illusion. like all literature.
And I, you know, I wonder, you know, Sarah and Heather, how you're grappling with her treatment of her own daughter, you know, given that this is somebody who really made readers feel empowered because they felt understood. Sarah?
I think we're finding out again and again that character really cannot be correlated with art. And, you know, as Stephen said, we make this assumption that those who create art are, quote, good people. And Alice Munro in particular, her stories made so many people, not just in Canada, but around the world, feel less alone. And it turns out that we're not just less alone with the pain and the secrets that she described, but also the complicity of it. And that's just a whole lot to grapple with it. For me personally, I did not expect that Alice Munro's life and work would actually be a crime story and not the stories that she told.
Now, there is no shortage of renowned male artists who have disturbing personal histories. I mean, I can go through the list, but I won't. And as a society, we seem able to hold and accept that tension between celebrating an artist for their works while also recognizing that the person is violated or abused or supported abhorrent movements or views. When the artist is a man, and I wonder, Heather, if you have any thoughts on how this shifts, how we can hold that same contradiction for female artists?
Yeah, it is interesting because Alice Munro, she did, when you hear the story, did act in a way that we associate with men and the patriarchy. And when you think of art monsters, you usually think of men, but she took on this very, she espoused this patriarchal role. And I think, I think the difference for me between also the relationship between art an artist and their art, for me, an artist and a writer also internalizes the reader's minds. And Alice Munro had, you know, she had so many readers and she was speaking to them and she was internalizing their anxieties, their experiences. So in a lot of ways, her stories are also the stories of her readers. And so in that way, they don't quite belong to her. I think I see art as this kind of separate entity. The problem with her legacy is that younger generations are going to, and I've already seen it, you know, Gen Z has a more, you know, pur et dur stance towards the relationship between an artist and the artwork. And a lot of young women are not going to even touch Alice Munro now. And these wonders that, you know, we've been describing that exist in her stories, they are never going to have access to them because they are not going to want to deal with that. You know, I was slated to be on a panel to talk for, you know, a celebration of Alice Munro, and it was just canceled yesterday. And I was surprised because I thought, I thought we would just incorporate this new information because Andrea Robin Skinner, in her letter, she said she didn't want to tear down the legacy of Munro. She just wanted her story included in Alice Munro's story. And for me, it is. It is now. There was always this enigma around her life because she was so private. But now this is part of her story. And I think it will obviously be included. But and that for those readers who are turned off and younger readers who never want to come to her because they can't because of her actions, I'm totally fine with that. It's a personal decision everybody makes with art and artists.
Yeah. Well, for those of us who are fans, we're going to be processing this for a while. Thank you all so much. Heather O'Neill is the author of Lullabies for Little Children. Sarah Weinman is the author of The Real Lolita, The Kidnapping of Sally Horner, and the novel that scandalized the world. And Stephen Marsh wrote The Next Civil War, Dispatches from the American Future. You can find all the stories we bring you each week on the Sunday Magazine over on our website, cbc.ca/Sunday. I'm Megan Williams. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again next Sunday.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.